happy to find somebody I knew. Have you got my woman with a meningioma for tomorrow? Sorry, Mr. Marsh, no. Only the two men. Maybe I should try Kent Ward. So I headed off up the stairs to Kent, the neurology ward. For reasons known only to themselves, the management have recently rearranged our bed allocation, turning half the female neurosurgical ward into a ward for neurological stroke patients and relocating the displaced neurosurgical patients onto the neurosurgical ward on the next floor up. So I trudged up the stairs to the neurological ward. The entrance was locked, and I found that I had left my swipe card at home, so I rang the bell beside the door. I had to wait many minutes before the lock buzzed and I could push the door open. I walked down the yellow-walled corridor beyond, with the patient bays to one side, each with six beds, packed closely together like stalls in a cattle shed. "Have you got any of my patients for surgery tomorrow?" I said, hopefully, to a tall male nurse sitting at the nursing station. He looked dubiously at me. "I'm Mr. Marsh, the consultant neurosurgeon," I said, irritated at not being recognised in my own hospital. "Bernadette's in charge. She's with a patient in the shower," he replied in a bored voice. So I waited until Bernadette, wearing a pair of large white Wellington boots and a plastic apron, emerged from the shower room, leading a bent and elderly woman on a Zimmer frame. "Oh, Mr. Marsh," she said with a smile, "are you on your usual hunt for your patients? We haven't got any here this evening." "This really is driving me nuts," I said. "I don't know why I bother. It's taken me 20 minutes just not to find one patient. Maybe she's not coming in this evening after all." Bernadette smiled sympathetically at me. I found the second patient, the young doctor, sitting at one of the tables outside on the balcony between the male and female surgical wards, working on his laptop. The original plans for this wing of the hospital, built 10 years ago, had been for a bigger building than the one which was eventually built. It was built under the Private Finance Initiative, favoured by the government of the time, and as with most PFI schemes, the design of the building was dull and unoriginal. Nor was it cheap, since PFI has proved to be a very expensive way of building second-rate public buildings. Some would consider PFI to be an economic crime, although nobody is to be held responsible for it. It is clear now that PFI was part of the same debt-crazed culture that gave us collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps and all those other dishonest acronyms and financial derivatives that have brought us, though not the bankers, to the edge of ruin. Various parts of the design were lopped off, resulting in large and unusual balconies outside the wards. The hospital management did not see this as an opportunity for improving the patient's experience of being in hospital, and instead saw it only as a suicide risk. Patients and staff were banned from the balconies, and the glass doors leading onto them were kept locked. It took me many years of campaigning and large sums of charitable money raised, which then went to the private company who built and owned the building, to have a small section of the balconies suicide-proofed by raising the glass balustrades. I could then have the enclosed area turned into a roof garden. It has proved hugely popular with both staff and patients, and on summer weekends, if the weather is fine, there is the happy sight of the ward beds almost all empty, with the patients and their families out on the balcony, surrounded by green plants and small trees beneath large umbrellas. This particular patient was an ophthalmic surgeon in his early 40s. A gentle, mild-mannered man, which ophthalmic surgeons tend to be. He looked younger than his years, and I knew that he had 3 young children. He worked in the north, but had chosen to be treated away from his own hospital. 5 years earlier, he had suffered a single epileptic fit and a scan had shown a tumour growing in his brain at the back on the right. I had operated and removed most of the tumour, but the analysis showed it to be of a type that would eventually grow back in a malignant form. He had made a good recovery, but it was some time before he had regained sufficient confidence to get back to work. He had known that the tumour would recur, but we had both hoped that it would take more than 5 years. He had radiotherapy treatment after the first operation and had remained perfectly well, but a routine follow-up scan had now shown the tumour was growing back again, and that it also now looked malignant. Further surgery might buy him a little more time, but it was unlikely to be more than 5 years. I sat down beside him. He looked up from his laptop. "Here we go again," he said with a sad smile. "Well, it's only a small recurrence," I said. "I know it can't be cured," he said bitterly, "but you'll take out as much as you can, won't you? This thing," and he waved his arm towards his head, "that is slowly doing me in?" "Yes, of course," I replied, handing him the consent form to sign. Like all patients, he scarcely glanced at it, and with a pen scrawled his name in the place I indicated. He had come to see me in my outpatient clinic some weeks earlier, and we had talked over the details of the operation. We both knew what awaited him, and there was nothing to say. Doctors treat each other with a certain grim sympathy. The usual rules of professional detachment and superiority have broken down, and painful truth cannot be disguised. When doctors become patients, they know the colleagues treating them are fallible, and they can have no illusions, if the disease is a deadly one, about what awaits them. They know that bad things happen and that miracles never occur. I cannot even begin to imagine what I would think or feel if I knew that a malignant tumour was starting to destroy my brain. "You're first on the list tomorrow," I said as I pushed my chair away and stood up. 8:30 sharp. 3 days earlier, the juniors had admitted an alcoholic man in his 40s who had been found collapsed on the floor of his home with the left side of his body paralysed. We had discussed his case at the morning meeting in the slightly sardonic terms that surgeons often use when talking about alcoholics and drug addicts. This does not necessarily mean that we do not care for such patients, but because it is so easy to see them as being the agents of their own misfortune, we can escape the burden of feeling sympathy for them. The brain scan had shown a hemorrhagic glioblastoma. "See if he gets better on steroids, and we can also wait and see if any family or friends turn up," I had declared. "His wife kicked him out of the family home some time ago," the registrar presenting the case said, "because of the booze." "Wife beater?" somebody asked. "I don't know." I found him lying sprawled on his bed, his paralysis a little better as a result of the steroids. He was a few years younger than me, overweight, with a florid red face and straggly long grey hair. I had to make a conscious decision to sit down on his bed next to him. I did not look forward to the conversation we were going to have. It is always easier to stay standing at the bedside, towering over the patient, and to leave as quickly as possible. "Mr. Mayhew," I said, "I'm Henry Marsh, the senior consultant. What have you been told so far about why you are here?"
"I've been told 5 different things, he said desperately. "I don't know."
His voice was slurred by his paralysis, and the left side of his face drooped lopsidedly. "Well, what did you understand?"
"There's a tumour in my head."
"Well, I'm afraid that's true."
"Is it cancer?"